Please remember to watch your language.
Look, I can't speak without swearing, and I've only got my grade 10, and I haven't had a cigarette since I've been arrested, and I'm ready to f***ing snap. So I'd like to make a request under the People's Freedom of Choices and Voices Act that I be able to smoke and swear in your courtroom. Because if I can't smoke and swear, I'm f***ed.
The following programming may contain content that some listeners find offensive. If you are sensitive to foul language or explicit content, please turn your radio the f*** off now.
It's the presidential edition of Radio Free Thinker. This week, how do you get elected as president? How much power does a president really have? And how does the U.S. party system really work? Let's begin episode 355.
It's time for Radio Free Thinker, the show that applies skepticism and critical thinking to everyday issues. Place where reason and reality cross sword, politics, religion, economics, and of course, science. Now let's get ready to be skeptical.
The cosmos is also within us. We're made of smart stuff. We are aware of the cosmos and know itself.
Across the sea of space, the stars are other suns. We've traveled this way before. And there is much to be learned.
Hello and welcome. Tis I, Don, your skeptical philosopher and political scientist. Well, it seems that the world may narrowly avoid the apocalypse with the possible collapse of the Donald Trump campaign. That said, as much as a buffoon, bigoted, misogynistic ass that Trump truly is, given the recent email leaks about Clinton and her significant other, given what would be in any other campaign, fatal baggage. Well, let me just say, I wouldn't rule out anything. As Trump repeatedly states, I may not be perfect, but what have you got to lose? And as it seems that Hillary, although likely to become the first woman to be president, she's still just another politician. So let's play out what might happen. What if Donald Trump became president? How much power does the American president actually have? First off, we should point out that he has far, far, far less power than Canada's prime minister, relatively speaking. But to start, we should first explore how one becomes president. The path to the White House begins, traditionally, with a potential candidate forming an exploratory committee, which consists of a selection of party elders and those in the know and or with experience. This committee assesses a potential candidates along four main lines. First, and unfortunately foremost, money. Can they afford to run? It is not a case of personal wealth, although that helps. It takes about $10 million, at least this time around, just to set up office. Oh yes, and to pay for the fundraising. Of that $10 million setting up money, about half of it is just to set up the machinery for fundraising. Then you look at about $5 to $50 million per state, mainly for advertising. This is why usually after a couple of states, most candidates drop out. The money to mount an effective campaign has run out, and they are unable to maintain reliable backing to continue. So you spend your money. Then what happens? Well, each state has a primary or caucus. Some have both. This is where the people vote for whom they wish to be the nominee for the party of their choice. Some of these events are termed closed primaries, in that only card-carrying Republicans can vote for the Republican races, and Democrats only vote for Democrats. This has had the effect in the U.S., mainly on the Republican side, of forcing candidates further and further to the extreme right. Because you've filtered who can vote, coupled with low voter participation, the main people to vote in primaries are the most radical members of the party. This is how the Tea Party has had such a distortional impact on the American politics. Then, of course, you have semi-closed primaries, where people mark an affiliation at a primary, but can switch on the election day. This is intended to open up the process to independents, as card-carrying Dems are not allowed to vote. This is in hopes of encouraging independents to join the party, but it also helps the party pick the most electable candidate, as independents often swing the election one way or another. There are open primaries in which anyone can show up and cast their ballots, irrespective of their official party status. This has the effect of selecting the person that is most likely to get the votes in a general election. Not only do you get the feeling for independence, but you also get wayward or waffling members of other parties. We see this playing out with the Republicans now, as many Republicans will not vote for Trump and thus are open to crossing the floor, so to speak, and vote Democrat. The fear of open primaries is what is called swamping effect. That is, not only are independents allowed to vote, but members of the other party as well. So as witnessed in the 1998 in a Senate race for Vermont, when local Fred Tuttle defeated the establishment Republican candidate, only to promptly endorse the Democratic candidate. It is possible for members of the other party to vote for the opposition candidate least likely to win. They also have semi-open primaries, and damned if I could find out what that actually meant and how it differed from semi-closed. Now, we use the term primary here with regards to open and closedness, but the Americans have two kind of nomination processes. Primaries, which are kind of like little elections. These are private votes held over a single day. What we think of an election normally. But that's not good enough for the Yanks. They have these things called caucuses. Throwbacks to the Wild West days, I assume. This is where a bunch of people gather in a room. Think school gym, where they literally split to form small groups, each with their own area of space, each group being made up of those who support a particular candidate. Then the remainder of the evening is spent with members of each faction trying to convince supporters of the other candidate to leave their group and join that person right over there, wherever that candidate's faction is congregated. Then, after several hours of haranguing, a tally is made of the number of people in each group, and delegates are allocated accordingly. Of course, this also means that if you leave early, then you did not actually vote in the caucus, because only those who stay to the end have their votes counted. So the Democratic Party has 17 open primaries and 4 open caucuses, 11 closed caucuses, and 13 closed primaries. They also have 4 semi-open caucuses and 1 semi-open primary. And lastly, 9 primaries that were semi-closed. Republicans had 13 closed caucuses, 16 closed primaries, 2 open caucuses, and 15 open primaries, along with 8 semi-closed primaries and 1 semi-closed caucuses, and 1 convention, just to be different. Now, those astute at math may have noticed the Republicans have 56 votes and the Dems have 59. But there are only 50 states. What gives? Well, the Republican discrepancy can be accounted for by the U.S. territories, in particular Puerto Rico, America Samoa, Guam, U.S. Virgin Islands, the District of Columbia, and the North Mariana Islands. What makes this weird is that although these people get to vote in the primaries, they don't get to vote in the actual presidential election, nor the House of Representatives. Well, technically they do have a representative, but that representative, much like the people they supposedly represent, has no actual right to vote on anything. Now, that may explain most of the extra primaries, but there's still 3 more primaries on the Democratic side that have yet to be accounted for. I should note that the selection of delegates, the appropriation, is left completely to the state party apparatus. Thus, there's no unified system of primary election. And that also means that Washington and Nebraska have both primaries and caucuses, although primaries no longer actually elect any delegates. Why have them? Who knows? The best I can come up with is that because primaries are most likely an actual election, the party hopes to get a better feel who is likely to show up to vote, while caucuses are more for the hardcore politicos. Still, our math is not complete. It seems the Democrats care about the feelings and thoughts of expats, so they have 1 special primary for, quote, Democrats living abroad. There were primaries set up in 39 countries, 12 in Canada, weirdly 13 in Germany. Also in the weirdo meter, there are primaries in Russia, Vietnam, and even the United Arab Emirates, but not Saudi Arabia, Israel, Brazil, or even South Korea, which has the 7th largest expat population. Okay, those are the delegates voted for by the people. Although depending on the state, these delegates may or may not vote as the plurality of their state dictated. And then there is the Democratic Party. Beyond the elected delegates, those who supposedly represent the will of the people, each party has a number of what they call superdelegates. These are deemed elder statesmen, power brokers of the powerful, the chamber of sober second thought of the nomination process. Well, it seems Republicans have 150 superdelegates, but according to the bylaws of the Republican Party, this year, they must vote as their state voted. Well, this is a small potatoes for the Republican nomination process. On the Democratic side, there are over 700 superdelegates, and these delegates are not bound to vote anyway but their conscience. Now, to be elected, a Democratic nominee needs 2,842 delegates to win the nomination. When over 12% of the delegates are super, you can win the nomination with only 30% of the popular vote, the remaining 20 being those magical superdelegates. Well, that said, the popular vote for Bernie was 1,865, while Clinton got 2,842, but which was really 2,271 compared to Sanders' 1,821. And of the 30-plus actual votes, Bernie got 43%, while Clinton got 56%. Okay, so sorry, Bernie or bus people. He really, really did lose. And yes, it was likely a conspiracy, but of the normal kind. So there you have it. Whoever elects the most delegates, delegates. I was under the impression that in a democracy, you actually voted for whom you wanted to lead the country. Well, let me be pedantic. We do not, have not for millennia, lived in a democracy. Some caveats expected. Yes, the Paris Commune of 1871 and the Spanish Republic of 1936. What we think of as democracy is actually representative democracy. That is, we do not ourselves vote on laws of the land, but elect individuals who, by proxy, vote on our behalf what should be the laws of the land. Well, the U.S. does not, at least presidential primary-wise, qualify as either a democracy nor a representative democracy, but an indirect democracy. That is, the people are not actually casting votes for the candidate A or B, but a surrogate or delegate who will, at the party convention, vote on their behalf. Now, this is where things can get either strange or exciting, depending on your perspective. So, by the laws of most, perhaps all states, I only have so much time, people, a delegate to the presidential nomination convention must vote as the popular vote dictated on the first vote. Now, if a presidential nominee has more than 50% of the delegates, well, they are the party's nominee. But if any single candidate fails that majority on the first ballot, well, then you get what they call a brokered convention. This is where politics returns to the nomination process, because now the delegates are free to switch their vote to another candidate. This is where party bosses get together and start horse trading. This is one reason that the Democrats have so many superdelegates to enable this backroom dealing before the convention. Nominations of note. In 1924, the Democratic Convention was split between two factions, the Wets and the Dries. The Dries were led by William G. McAdoo, who was a committed prohibitionist, whereas the Wets, who were against the ban on booze, were led by Alfred E. Smith. Now, in most conventions, the winner is known after the first ballot, but this voting went on for 14 days. It was not until the 103rd ballot that the dark horse John W. Davis was chosen as a compromise candidate. This Democratic Convention was noteworthy as well for the official inclusion of the Ku Klux Klan, who endorsed McAdoo, who welcomed the endorsement. Seemed he thought alcohol was bad for the nation, but racism was okay. Some Democrats did attempt to make it a party policy to condemn the Klan. However, the Klan had enough support to defeat this motion, and to celebrate their win, they had a massive rally in the fields in New Jersey, which later became known as the Great Democratic Klan Bake. During the convention, the Klan burned crosses, urged violence and intimidation against African Americans and Catholics, and attacked effigy of Smith. Smith was, after all, a Catholic. What else were they supposed to do? It is believed that this Democratic embrace of the Klan played a major factor in the defeat of the Democratic candidate. Like, duh. Another quirk I noticed is that the only other brokered conventions in the 20th century, well, they happened in the same year. In 1952, both the Democratic and Republican conventions were brokered. Eisenhower won that year. And then you have the 1968 Democratic Convention, where the winner, Herbert Humphreys, won on the first ballot with a comfortable majority, even though he entered the race late and did not win a single primary. How is this possible? Well, in 1968, the majority of delegates were not elected via primary, but selected in state conventions, conventions tightly controlled by the party bosses. So although 80% of the primary voters did not vote for Humphreys, he ended up, thanks to the party system, with over 67% of the delegates. It was after Humphrey's disastrous loss that the Democrats revamped their nomination process, and almost all delegates are popularly elected. So there you have it. You are finally nominated to be the presidential candidate for your party. All you have to do now is win the national election. And on that note, let's pause to take a bit of a break.
Hey, why so sad?
Oh, nothing really.
Not very convincing, Jane girl. Whatever it is, I've got just the cure for it.
1, 2, 3!
Did you know CITR has a women's collective? This brand new collective is all about providing and fostering a community for women who are or who want to be in radio, fighting the gender disparity in media, and centering women's voices and issues. If you are a female-identified person or ally who's already involved in radio or wants somewhere to start, this collective is for you. Email womenscollective@citr.ca for more information and to get involved.
And tune in Friday at 6 p.m. for the collective show, Lady Radio, featuring music, interviews, events, news, commentary, basically anything we care to talk about. See you then.
Well, how do you like it?
There's only one word for it. Terrific.
You know, I'm so proud of it, it's almost indecent of me.
Would you like to get updates on your smartphone in an emergency, even if a cell tower is down? It is possible if the FM chip is activated in your phone. Visit freeradioonmyphone.ca to see how you can get involved by contacting your carrier and signing our petition.
You're listening to Radio Free Thinker on 101.9 FM, your primary source of skeptical news and critical thinking. And we're back. So, you won the nomination process, and now all you have to do is win the national election. Quick side note, although there is a Federal Elections Commission in the States, it does not set up the rules of the federal election like Elections Canada does here. Now, its primary task is to enforce the federal campaign finance laws. All other aspects of voting, both presidential or for Congress, including primaries, are controlled at the state level. This is why it's impossible to talk about one single mechanism for voting in the U.S. Now, of course, most of what politicians have to do to win the election is, well, make speeches, shake hands, kiss babies, what they call retail politics. But they also have to raise money, and this is what I will call wholesale politics. Because in trying to woo wealthy donors, the candidate will wholesale their ethics and dignity for that much-needed cash. How much money? Well, during the 2012 election, the nominees together raised $2 billion. This year, they're expected to raise $5 billion. And yes, that's billions with a B. To put this in some sort of context, the 1960 presidential campaign cost $162 million adjusted dollars. The 1980 election saw the election of Ronald Reagan, and I had a number of expletives lined up, but this is a classy show. The 1980 election cost $320 million. Hell, even the infamous 2000 election, which saw a judicial coup in the U.S., only cost a mere $420 million. It was not really until 2008 election that we saw our first billion-dollar election. Why? Well, the 2012 election saw the first election with Citizen United, a Supreme Court ruling that said money was free speech and no limits should be placed upon it. This is the second presidential election after that case. And to be fair, there are a number of other less-known cases that make money in politics more effective. There will likely be a doubling of spending yet again. In an ironic twist, it is the disastrous campaign of Donald Trump that may actually suppress the spending. First, because fewer Republican donors will want to support the that is Trump, and less perceive the need to spend for Clinton because, well, how could she possibly lose to the Donald? Okay, so let's pretend that it's November 8th of 2016. The people vote for the president, or not. The U.S. has a different take on democracy, as in a slightly unexpected form. In that, it's a republic, which means it's not a true democracy, where the citizens of the country vote on each law or action of the government of that country. And to be fair, that, it seems, is not so unusual. The only place I could find that still has true or direct democracy are two cantons, think provinces, of Switzerland. And I will not embarrass you with my mispronunciation of their name. And yes, to be the more A-type personality out there, there are a few towns in the U.S. that may qualify. And yes, again, I know that referendums are a form of direct democracy, but beyond that, most democracies are actually representative democracy, like we have here in Canada. Representative democracies vote directly via elections for the people who will pass the laws and the like. The American Founding Fathers thought were short of praise for democracy and often feared it. Rule of the mob was more their opinion on the matter. That is why only one part of the U.S. government was originally intended to be voted on by the masses, and that was the House of Representatives. The U.S. is a republic. What does that actually mean? Well, to quote the founding father James Madison in the Federalist Papers, which are intended to explain and defend the various parts of, at the time, proposed Constitution of the United States. In the same subject continued, the Union as a safeguard against domestic factions and insurrection, or more commonly stated, the Federalist Number 10, Madison stated that what distinguished a democracy from a republic was that the former became weaker as it got larger and suffered more violent forms of the effect of faction, whereas a republic could get stronger as it got larger and combats factions by its very nature. Factions here are like political parties, that kind of thing. So as it turns out, like with the presidential primaries, the actual presidential election is also an exercise in indirect voting. What do I mean? Well, when you vote for president, you're not actually voting for Trump or Clinton, but you are voting for a member of the Electoral College. And these are the ones who will, a full month after the popular vote, select who will be president of the United States. So who are these electors that the people of the U.S. are actually voting for, even if they don't know it? The U.S. Constitution requires that each state legislature determine how electors for that state are to be chosen, with certain caveats that any person holding a federal office, either elected or appointed, is disqualified from being an elector. That people who forswore an oath or rebellion against the U.S., are disqualified unless a two-thirds majority of the House votes to revoke that disqualification. Candidates for elector are nominated by their state political parties in the months prior to Election Day. In some states, the electors are nominated in primaries, the same way that candidates are nominated. In other states, electors are nominated in party conventions. In Pennsylvania, the campaign committee of each state names their candidate for elector in an attempt to discourage faithless electors. Each state gets as many electors as it has senators, which is to say two, and House representatives, anywhere from one for Wyoming, and as many as 55 for California, for a grand total of 538. Now, some of my more obsessive listeners, yes, I'm counting myself in that glorious crowd, may have noticed that this is not actually the number of congressmen, that there are three extras. These belong to the District of Columbia, which is strange in one sense. Like in the primaries, Washington gets to have a say in who is nominated for president, but yet has no actual voting members in Congress. Now, most states allocate their electors in an all-or-nothing manner. That is, if Trump wins Texas with 13,734,558 votes, i.e. half the population plus one, he gets all the 38 electors, and Clinton gets a big fat zero. Now, there are some exceptions. Maine, since 1972, and Nebraska, since 1996, use congressional district method, selecting one elector within each congressional district by popular vote and selecting the remaining two electors by statewide popular vote. This is a bad thing because of gerrymandering, but that's another show. Okay, it has been kind of strange so far, but now it gets weird. After Election Day and the votes are tallied, each state prepares seven, yes, seven, as in one less than eight, certificates of attainment, each listing the candidate for president and vice president, their pledged electors, and the total votes each candidate received. One certificate and two copies, for some reason, are sent as soon after Election Day as practical to the National Archivist in Washington, D.C. On the first Monday after the second Wednesday in December, the electors meet in their respective states. This time, that would be December 19th. The electors record their vote on six certificates of vote, which are paired with the six remaining original certificates of assertment. Okay, so now we have six pairs. One is sent to the National Archive, two are sent to the President of the United States Senate, i.e. the current Vice President, two are sent to the Secretary of State of each state, and lastly, the final pair are sent to the Chief Judge of the Federal District Court, located where the electors meet. Why? Redundancy. Maybe the others will get lost in the mail. We are not done yet, folks. And I thought the primaries were convoluted. On January 6th, at 1 p.m. before the joint session of Congress, the Vice President opens up the vote from each state in alphabetical order. He passes the vote to four tellers, two from the House and two from the Senate, who announce the results. House tellers include one representative from each party and are appointed by the Speaker. At the end of the count, the Vice President then declares the name of the next president. Okay, skip ahead a few seconds as I nerd out. Members of Congress can object to any state's vote, provided that objection is presented in writing and is signed by at least one member of each House of Congress. An objection supported by at least one senator and one representative will be followed by a suspension of the joint session and by separate debate and vote in each House of Congress. After both Houses deliberate on the objection, the joint session is resumed. A state certificate of vote can be rejected only if the House of Congress votes to accept the objection. In that case, the votes from the state in question are simply ignored. The votes of Arkansas and Louisiana were rejected in the presidential election of 1872. Getting back to the voting, the presiding officer simply announced the final results of the vote and, provided that the required absolute majority of votes was achieved, declares the name of the person elected president and vice president. But what happens if a presidential candidate did not get a clear majority of electors? In this event, the House of Representatives is required to go into session immediately to vote for president if no candidate for president receives a majority of the electoral votes. The House of Representatives is limited to choose from among the three candidates who receive the most electoral votes. Each state delegation votes in block, each delegation having a single vote. And this actually happened twice, once in 1801 and again in 1825. A similar process occurs for vice president, but his votes are done in the Senate. And the only time the Senate elected a VP was in 1837. What happens if the House is divided and no one candidate has a majority? First off, the VP-elect, i.e. the one the Senate or Electoral College said won, becomes acting president until the House figures things out And since 1947, the Speaker of the House would become acting president. Either the House selects a president or the Senate selects a vice president. Side note, there have been 9 informal acting presidents. That said, prior to 1967 and the 25th Amendment to the U.S. Constitution, this became a lawful term. Since then, there have been 3 acting presidents, and 2 of them were Dick Cheney, who had supreme U.S. power while Bush was having surgery. Okay, that is how a person becomes president of the United States of America. So let's ask the next question. If Trump won, just how much power does the president of the United States actually have? And on that note, we'll pause for a break.
Nothing goes together better than live music and a beer. Or 2. Or 5. Wait a minute. An estimated 886,000 Canadians age 15 and older abused or were dependent on alcohol in 2012. 1 in 7 Canadians age 15 years and older experience verbal, emotional, and physical abuse as a result of another person's drinking. Make sure a fun night out doesn't ruin everyone else's, or your own. If you see yourself or someone you know slightly off key, help everyone out and step in. After all, you want to be able to remember the show tomorrow morning.
How do you listen to CITR? Do you stream it with your data? You could be getting it free on your phone with the already installed FM receiver chip, but major carriers have blocked access to it. If you want access to all your favorite CITR goodness on your phone, get involved. Visit freeradioonmyphone.ca to see how you can get involved by contacting your carrier and signing our petition.
You're listening to Radio Freethinker and CITR 101.9 FM Vancouver, your duly nominated and elected skeptical radio broadcast. And we're back. So how much power does the President of the U.S. actually have? Well, to answer that question, we need to have a better understanding of how the American system of government works. First, beyond the standard platitudes that the American government is a series of checks and balances, what that means in reality is that there are 3 levels of governance, 2 of which are important or emblematic of Yankee democracy, and that each level has 3 branches intended to be both co-equal and counterbalancing. First, the 3 level governments are federal, state, and municipal. Municipal powers are dictated by the states, so for our discussion, not much of a player. The Constitution, along with tradition, has created a tension between state rights and federal government. Unlike in Canada, where the roles and powers of each level of government are clearly stated out, in the U.S., the demarcation points where state rights end and federal jurisdiction starts has been largely defined by the Supreme Court. Because in recent years there's been a strong swing of power towards the federal government, states will not likely be an impediment to any Trump presidency. Okay, but beyond the scope of powers, there's also what I would like to call the theater of power. That is the federal system, and in most state systems, there are 4 arms of governance. Well, technically there's actually 3, but one of the arms is split into 2, hence the reference to 4. What do I mean? Well, one branch of power is legislative. The people actually vote on laws of the land. In Canada, this is effectively the parliament, with the Senate having a nominal advisory role. In the U.S., Congress has supreme legislative power. That is, they are the body responsible for writing and enacting all the laws on the state or nation. Originally, only the House of Representatives were elected by the people. The Founding Fathers had their distrust of true democracy and mob rule by the masses. So to counter mob rule, the Senate was to be appointed by the respective state legislatures. It was not until 1913 and the 17th Amendment that the senators were directly elected by the people. Beyond the powers of legislation, they also have, largely by tradition, approval powers on candidates for executive position, such as the Supreme Court, cabinet posts, like the Secretary of State, and high-ranking military posts, such as the head of the CIA. Congress also has a set of enumerated powers, those explicitly set out in the Constitution, and a set of implied powers given to them by the Constitution's Necessary and Proper Clause, which states that Congress can pass any law it deems necessary and proper to carry out its explicit powers. So the federal government has the enumerated power to control commerce between states and nations, the Commerce Clause. This was used during the New Deal era to support price controls on farmers, the latter being deemed necessary in order to carry out the former. Of course, once a law is passed, someone must enforce it. And that leads us to the second branch of the U.S. government, the executive branch. The president is head of the executive branch. Quick side note, the only other official member of the executive branch is the vice president, who weirdly is also the president of the Senate, and can cast a deciding vote in the Senate if it is deadlocked. This has happened 242 times, with the first VP holding the record at 29 tie-breaking votes. And this is not ancient history. Richard Nixon and Dick Cheney cast 8 tie-breaking votes. Bush Sr. cast 7. Even Al Gore cast 4. That said, Joe Biden has not had to cast a deciding vote during his 8-year tenure as VP. What powers does the president have? 1. He appoints cabinet secretaries, high-ranking military officers, the Supreme Court justices. But as already mentioned, he does this with the consent of the Senate. That said, he has the authority to appoint people temporarily when Congress is out of session. But that person can only remain in the post until the end of the next session of Congress. He also has the power to pardon. And from what my research has shown, this is a complete and absolute power. And was used, I would say for good, like when Washington pardoned the leaders of the Whiskey Rebellion in 1791 to help facilitate an end to that conflict. Andrew Jackson and Ulysses S. Grant pardoned the Confederate soldiers. Woodrow Wilson pardoned George Burdick, editor of the New York Times, who was sent to jail for refusing to reveal sources in an expose of the Treasury Department, what I would think a pivotal point for freedom of the press. That said, it has also been used, perhaps abused, like when George H. Bush pardoned the people involved in the Iran-Contra affair. Bill Clinton pardoned 140 people on his last day in office, including wealthy donor. And of course, the most infamous one, Gerald Ford's absolute pardon of Richard Nixon. Beyond pardons, the president can create and sign treaties, be they military, economic, or other. But again, the Senate must ratify those treaties, or else they remain simply a piece of paper. And the president is the one who must enact and enforce the laws passed by Congress. This does allow the president some latitude with regards to which law he prioritizes and which he neglects. For example, via presidential order, some immigration laws have been, well, let's not use the word suspended, as he, explicitly, has no authority to suspend laws and must always give the appearance of faithfully executing U.S. law. Taking all that into consideration, there is a lot of gray area. Conversely, the president may wish to enforce a law, create some project, but all of this can be thwarted by Congress, who can defund offices of government or deny funding the projects. As we've seen in the Obama presidency, there are some minor things around the edges the president can do, but largely we've seen in the 8 years of Obama that if Congress and judiciary are against the person in office, there is very little the president can actually get done. And with the president's veto power, not much of anything gets done. Ergo, the many times the U.S. government came to a halt because a budget could not be passed, or to put it more delicately, a U.S. federal funding gap. Yes, that sounds much better. And on a side note, we might think this a modern invention, the animosity of the Hell No Republicans and the naive President Obama. But the first funding gap happened during Ford, and again under Carter. But it was not until Reagan that the government actually shut down for 2 whole days. It happened under Clinton for a whopping 21 days. It makes the 16-day shutdown under Obama seem short. Lastly, and perhaps most worrying with regards to presidential candidate Trump, the president is also the commander-in-chief of the armed forces. It is explicitly stated in the Constitution that only Congress may declare war. That said, arguments have been made that the Constitution does not prevent the president to make war, the justification being based on necessity if the United States is suddenly attacked. However, in recent years, the power of Congress to curtail U.S. military action and the president's increasing scope to instigate military action has accelerated. Although passing legislation for the war on terror, the president has effectively used this law and the calls for war on terrorism to justify the Afghan war, the Iraq war, attacks in Syria, Libya, various other states in Asia and Africa, all under the pretext of war on terror. Okay, but as I said, or maybe implied, the use of the military by a president beyond the explicit mandate can only occur if Congress allows it, which one could imply as an implicit vote of approval. But what happens when the president says a law allows him to do something and Congress disagrees? Well, this leads to the final pillar of the U.S. government, the judiciary. Although Congress may pass a law and the president has the task to enact it, ultimately, the judiciary has the final say. The Supreme Court of the U.S. is the final and absolute arbiter of the law. In the 1970s, Nixon made the claim that when the president does something, that, by the very nature of who is doing it, made it legal. To quote Nixon in 1977, When the president does it, that means it's not illegal, by definition. Unfortunately for Nixon, that's not the case. When the Supreme Court makes a ruling, that is, by definition, the law, full stop. There is no appeal, no higher authority. That is one of the reasons the appointment of replacement justices, such as the vacancy left by Antonin Scalia, is such a political fight. People placed in the Supreme Court are there for life. Their influence can span decades, and thanks to other precedents, there's no mechanism for any other branch of government, or for that matter, the court itself, to influence or pressure a court member or the court itself. So there you have it. Even if Trump were elected, it is not likely he could be the disaster that I'm sure he is trying his hardest to be. That said, we've only fleshed out the legal ways he exercises his power. One might ask, is there a way for the President of the States to become a true dictator, as so many fear Trump's true ambition? Well, firstly, there is precedent for the President to act outside the law. There is FDR's attack on the German fleet prior to the declaration of war, Nixon and his illegal military actions against Laos and Cambodia, and let's not forget his acts of sabotage at the peace agreement with Vietnam in 1968, and his illegal activities to undermine the Democrats in 1972. More recently, we had government spying on its own citizens, the most blatant example being the program Total Information Awareness that Congress explicitly voted to bar, and yet is still in effect today. We know this thanks to Edward Snowden. That said, there is no way for Trump or anyone else to seize power by political or legal maneuvering. That said, there has been at least one attempt to overthrow the U.S. government via military coup. That was in 1933, the business plot. Apparently, wealthy business types and ultra-conservatives, i.e. fascists, approached the popular General Butler and tried to persuade him to use his influence over disaffected World War I vets to rise up an army that would forcibly confine Roosevelt, for the sake of his health, of course. And then, leaving FDR as a figurehead, General Butler would rule the nation with absolute power as the Secretary of General Affairs. It seems the plotters, though, picked the wrong guy. Although Butler was an army man and Republican, the Great Depression seems to have turned him into a socialist and very much anti-capitalist. So he blew the whistle on the plot, which seems to have had no ramifications other than making such a plot completely unviable. Okay, so it seems as bad as Trump presidency will be, and it will be horrific, he does not actually have the power to destroy the world. Oh, wait, feck. I did forget one thing. He has the codes. One of the powers of the Supreme Commander of the Armed Forces is that he has the launch codes. In briefings with security analysis, apparently Trump repeatedly asked, if we have nuclear weapons, why haven't we used them? So it is conceivable, maybe even likely, that Trump, having been insulted by, let's say, our own Justin Trudeau, might seek retribution, not for the personal attack on the size of his hands, but the insult that reflects on the people of the United States in general, and may use those nuclear weapons. So this may seem way over the top, but there have been numerous examples in history of loose cannons who have succeeded in attaining the power to wreak havoc on the world. I don't know about you, but I would invest in a bomb shelter, or maybe just think about moving to Russia. That seems to be Trump's happy place. We'll return with some web wisdom about the U.S. party system after this break.
Open Media International is a nonprofit, nonpartisan organization working towards informed, citizen-driven internet policy. Open Media believes in keeping the internet uncensored, open, innovative, secure, and providing universal access to fast and affordable networks. If you would like Open Media to keep campaigning for citizens and internet policy, you can donate to them at openmedia.org or openmedia.ca. You can also find them on YouTube, Twitter, Facebook, and Google+.
Your cell phone already has an FM receiver chip installed in it, but major Canadian telecommunication and mobile companies have blocked access to this free system to listen to the radio in favor of charging for data streaming. With access to the FM chip, your phone can still receive broadcasts and updates during an emergency, even if the cell towers are down. Visit freeradioonmyphone.ca to see how you can get involved by contacting your carrier and signing our petition.
You're listening to Radio Freethinker on CITR 101.9 FM, your nuclear-free zone for knowledge and critical thinking. And we're back. So we've talked a lot about being elected president and the powers such a position holds. But another major player in U.S. politics is the party system. What is it? Well, let's listen and learn to Crash Course clip about political parties. Let's listen and learn.
Hi, I'm Craig, and this is Crash Course Government and Politics, and today we're going to talk about parties.
Woo!
Yeah! No, not those kind of parties. We're talking about political parties, which can be a lot less fun. Woo. So today we're talking about why we have political parties and the role of parties in American politics. But before we dive into the pool, some would say a cesspool, that is political parties, let's have a definition. Political party, a team of politicians, activists, and voters whose goal is to win control of government. So kind of an important point. The goal of a party is to control government, and in the U.S., that means electing people who agree with and usually are members of the party. So above everything else, parties exist to win elections. Parties don't mainly focus on influencing policies, although particular policies are often associated with particular parties. Influencing elected officials is mainly the job of interest groups, who we'll talk about soon. For now, let's keep in mind that political parties and interest groups are not the same thing. So let's look at three reasons why we have political parties. One, I do know. I'll tell you in a second. First, we create political parties to facilitate collective action in the electoral process. Given that parties exist to win elections, this is probably the main reason we have them. But what does facilitate collective action in the electoral process mean exactly? Basically, it means that parties make it easier for voters to form groups that will vote in certain ways. Here's an example, albeit one that overgeneralizes a little bit. Just come on, just go with it. In general, Republican candidates support policies that are more friendly to business. So if you're a businessman, you know that affiliating yourself with the Republican Party is probably going to benefit you. The second reason given for forming political parties is that they facilitate policymaking. This reasoning applies to elected members who belong to political parties, not to voters. So membership in a party allows politicians to work together. It's easier for Democrats to form alliances with other Democrats, and sometimes these alliances have the added benefit of strengthening the party. Party affiliation can help legislators from different places work together. For example, common Republican should make it easier for a Republican from rural Kansas to work with another Republican from suburban Florida. Sometimes, though, party ideology can prevent even members of the same party from working together, as happened in 2008 when Republicans couldn't agree on whether the government should bail out struggling banks. A third, and I must say not altogether convincing, reason why we have political parties is to deal with the problem of politicians' ambition. According to this idea, parties provide a structure, maybe even a career ladder, for politicians so that they're not always acting in their own self-interest. The fact that the party provides different leadership possibilities and some sense of discipline prevents ambitious politicians with largely similar views from competing against each other. Like, say, 16 candidates running for president on the same party. Just wouldn't happen. Ever. So that's why political parties exist. But what do they do? Well, they have five main functions in the U.S., and I'll leave it up to you to decide which, if any, is the most important. The eagle doesn't get to decide. Eagle doesn't get to decide anything. So here's the list. 1. Recruit candidates. 2. Nominate candidates. 3. Get out the vote. 4. Facilitate electoral choice. 5. Influence national government. The first thing that parties have to do if they want to win elections is find candidates. This is a two-step process involving recruiting and nominating. We've already mentioned that in order to be a good candidate for office, you generally have to have an unblemished personal record, like me, or at least be really good at heartfelt apologies. I don't have an unblemished record, and I'm very sorry about that. Also, you need the ability to raise money. Of course, in order to avoid any problems with campaign financing, it's helpful to have money yourself. But why spend your own money if you can convince people to give money to your campaign? Maybe print out some hats. Merch works. Merch helps raise money. There are lots of people who want to run for office, although there's some debate about whether we're really getting the best candidates. The pay isn't great, and neither is the prestige anymore. And then there's the scrutiny that a run for office puts you and your family through. Parties play an important role in sifting through all the people who want to run and picking those who have the best chance of winning. Nomination is the process through which a potential candidate is actually chosen to represent a particular party in an election. When we talk about nominations in the U.S., we're mostly talking about the presidency, because that's the only office that goes through the formal nomination process. But technically, congressmen and senators are nominated by their parties to run as well. There are three ways that a candidate for president can be nominated. In the old days, presidential candidates were nominated at a convention, or caucus, which are gatherings of party members governed by rules. Conventions still occur every 4 years, but they're largely ceremonial these days because presidential candidates are actually nominated during the primaries. Let's go to the thought bubble. Primary elections are held to choose candidates who will then run in the later general election. Political parties decide when and how primaries will be held and who the candidates will be. These are the elections that pit Democrat against Democrat and Republican against Republican to see who will face off in November. November. Primaries can either be open or closed. Most states have closed primaries, which means that only registered voters of a particular party can vote in that election. So in a state with closed primaries, like New York, only Democrats can vote in the Democratic primary. And since in many districts one party is overwhelmingly dominant, the primary winner is very likely to win the general election, too. In states with open primaries, members of any party can vote in the primary, which sounds great because it encourages more participation, but it also opens up opportunities for mischief. For example, if there's a strong Republican candidate up against a weak Republican candidate in a state with open primaries, Democrats can turn up and vote for the weak Republican in the hopes that if he wins, he will have less of a chance in the general election running against a Democrat. Sneaky. In presidential elections, the winner of a primary election will be assigned a certain number of party delegates. Delegates are non-elected party members who actually nominate the candidates at the convention. The delegates are usually pledged to vote for the candidate who won the primary in their state, at least on the first ballot, and majority rules in nominating. This is why we see so much election coverage of primaries and why some states, like New Hampshire, try so hard to have their primaries early. Once a candidate has sewn up enough delegates, he or she becomes the nominee, and the convention serves largely as a formality. Although the primary system is more democratic than the convention, it still has problems. Even though there's more opportunity for participation, that doesn't mean people actually participate. In fact, only about 25% of those eligible to vote in primary elections actually do, and these tend to be the more ideologically extreme members of the parties, because to them, winning elections matters most. So if only partisan voters show up, we tend to get uber-partisan candidates. And because they have to win bruising primaries before they even get to the general election, these candidates tend to be aggressive and uncompromising. That's good when you're competing in an election, but not so good when you're trying to work with other people to craft policies, or in very rare cases, legislation. This is why many people think that primaries add to political polarization in the U.S. Thanks, Thought Bubble. You got my vote. There's a third way that a person can become a candidate, but it's a long and dangerous path. Hey, Stan, zoom the camera in as I say that. It's a long and dangerous path. A person can run as an independent, and if they get enough signatures on a petition, they can become a candidate. You're more likely to see this in congressional races, but even then, it's not super common. It's also really not that long and dangerous, as we implied in that last shot. The third thing that parties do is mobilize voters, also known as getting out the vote. This is pretty obvious because you can't elect a candidate if you don't get people out to vote for them. Duh. Parties get out the vote through direct mail, email, and advertisements, and they can also help with voter registration drives. The main thing the party does in terms of getting out the vote is coordinate volunteers to help encourage voting. If you want to help on a campaign or with an election effort, your local party office is a good place to start. Another good place to start is getting out of bed. Getting out the bed. Is a campaign we should have. Parties also help to facilitate electoral choice. Basically, a political party acts sort of like a brand, so knowing which party a candidate represents acts as a kind of shorthand for voters in the same way that seeing, say, a Netflix logo lets you know that you're about to chill. I'm not going to go into what each party stands for right now, but let's just say that knowing that a candidate is a Republican or a Democrat allows you to figure out pretty much what they stand for, even if you don't know anything about the candidate. Political parties even help nonpartisan voters by narrowing down political choices and making things easier. If you want to, you can choose a candidate by answering two relatively simple questions: which party better represents my interests and values, and which candidate belongs to that party. Finally, believe it or not, political parties have a role in the way the national government actually works. Party membership is really important in Congress. Parties determine who the speaker is, since he or she always comes from the majority party and is chosen by a vote of members of that party. Parties also determine the composition of the committees, and party leaders assign members to those committees. And parties help determine who the chairs of the committees are, and they, along with the speaker and the majority leader in the Senate, largely shape Congress's agenda. The president and his party have a reciprocal relationship. That's the best kind of relationship, and the most fun to say. Reciprocal. The president is the leader of his party, and his personal character and popularity helps to shape the party's brand, for better or worse, and can be used to raise money. On the other side, the party throws its support behind the president's initiatives and helps to elect candidates that support him in Congress. So at their most basic level, parties exist to elect political candidates and thus gain control of the government. In order for them to do this well, they need to provide voters with clear electoral preferences and encourage them to act on those preferences. In a way, this branding function, helping voters to choose between candidate A and candidate B, is what parties are all about. But you're free to disagree, and if you do, go form your own party. You can do whatever you want. It's a party. Woo! Hello, I'm Craig, and this is Crash Course Government and Politics, and today we're going to talk about, well, mostly history. Wait, Stan, this isn't Crash Course History. This must be some kind of exception, like the Mongols. Apparently we're not stepping on anybody's toes by talking about the history of American political parties, as long as we stay away from history in general. Thank goodness, we wouldn't want to start a Crash Course interdisciplinary feud. Just kidding, I'm totally feuding with that Phil guy over at Astronomy. Political Political historians like to divide America into eras according to which parties were active at the time. These are called party systems, and there have been five or six of them, depending on who you ask. I'm going to say there were six, but that's just me, and some political scientists and historians, but mainly me, because I'm the important one here. And not Phil from Astronomy. There were no parties during the first elections under the new Constitution in 1788, partly because the framers were afraid of parties, which Madison called factions, and partly because there was universal agreement that the first president of the U.S. should be George Washington. And so he was. It was only after he retired after his second term that voters started to break into political factions and vote based on their ideological leanings. Although, to call these factions parties is a bit of a stretch. Anyway, the first party system, which probably started in the 1796 election, included the Federalists, who supported Washington's Vice President John Adams, and the Democratic Republicans, who supported Thomas Jefferson. So, the Federalist Political Party was different than the group that worked to get the Constitution ratified, even though they were also called Federalists, and Alexander Hamilton was prominent in both groups. What the two parties believed isn't so important for this series. We talked about it in Crash Course U.S. History. But overall, the Federalists were supported by Northeastern business elites, especially merchants who wanted closer ties with England and those who generally wanted a stronger national government. The Democratic Republicans were more skeptical of national power and, when push came to shove, favored the more revolutionary French. Ultimately, the Democratic Republicans were way more successful. They were dominant in the presidential contests of the time, as Jefferson in 1800 and 1804, Madison in 1808 and 1816, and Monroe in 1820 and 1824 were all Democratic Republicans. Monroe's elections kind of don't count, though, as the Federalists weren't really a factor in national politics after 1815. In fact, the period between 1815 and 1824 is sometimes called the Era of Good Feelings. And that's how I like to refer to lunch every day. I just got it back from a 45-minute Era of Good Feelings. It was a burrito bowl. Yummy. Sadly, the Era of Good Feelings came to an end with the election of 1824, which saw John Quincy Adams defeat Andrew Jackson in a bitter election that ended up being decided in the House of Representatives. Jackson, ever the gracious loser, decried the election as a corrupt bargain and rode this angry sentiment to victory in the 1828 election. Jackson was a divisive figure in a lot of ways, especially if you like the Supreme Court or Native Americans. But from our perspective, he's really useful because his election helped to launch the second party system. Let's go to the thought bubble. The new party, called the Whigs, started out as an anti-Jackson party. They claimed Jackson was a tyrant, and they might have had a point. The second party system brought innovations to the political process, mostly in the party that opposed the Whigs. The Democratic Republicans rebranded themselves as the Democrats. These Democrats, especially under the leadership of Jackson's vice president and future magnificently bewhiskered president Martin Van Buren, introduced some of the features of politics that we still see today. They established a central party committee, state party organizations, and party newspapers. Okay, so we don't have party newspapers anymore because we don't really have newspapers anymore. The Democrats also established state and national conventions for nominating candidates. Before this, all candidates have been chosen by caucuses of party leaders, which is less, well, democratic. The Whigs were generally less successful in national elections, but they introduced flair into politics in the campaign of 1840, and we could all use a little more flair. This was the first time a Whig candidate, William Henry Harrison, won the presidency, and he introduced a great deal of political theater into running for office. The Whigs held parades featuring a rolling model of a log cabin that Harrison supposedly grew up in, he didn't, and copious amounts of hard cider for supporters. It also featured a giant ball covered in campaign slogans that supposedly spawned the phrase, keep the ball rolling, and gave us the first campaign slogan with both rhyming and alliteration. Tippecanoe and Tyler too. So catchy, it's still used to this day. I put it in my wedding vows. Do you take this woman? I do. And Tippecanoe and Tyler too. This came from Harrison's supposed status as the hero of the Battle of Tippecanoe, which introduced another aspect into American politics. The idea that successful candidates for president should, if at all possible, be war heroes. Thanks, Thought Bubble. Eventually, the issue of slavery pretty much destroyed the Whig Party and the election of Abraham Lincoln in 1860 ushered in the third party system. Lincoln ran and won as a Republican, and after 1860, the U.S. basically settled into a two-party system, with all elections basically between Democrats and Republicans. But over the years, the compositions of these parties, who supports each party, and what the party stands for, changed enough that we think of those shifts as creating new party systems. So the Republican Party was originally a conglomeration of reformers who coalesced around being against slavery. Republicans have always been pro-business and have tried to associate themselves with liberty. In fact, one of their earliest rallying cries was, free soil, free labor, free men. As viewers of the Crash Course U.S. History video on Reconstruction know, it was a pretty pivotal and divisive time in American history. In terms of political parties, though, this was when the southern states all tilted towards the Democratic Party, largely because Republicans were, correctly, seen as being responsible for ending slavery. Democrats during the third party system were a bit of an odd mix. Their strength came from white, largely racist southerners and working class immigrants in the north, many of whom gravitated to the Democrats because the Republicans tended not to like immigrants or alcohol. And many Republican reforms in this era were designed to keep middle class Protestant business elites in power. Another Another reason for Democrats' success in recruiting immigrant votes was that this was the era of political machines, which traded political appointments for support to win elections and maintain power. The most famous of these machines tended to be in big cities with large immigrant populations like Boston and New York, and they were mostly Democratic, although there were Republican political machines too, mostly in the Midwest. The supposed Democratic abuses of machines brought about electoral reforms like voter registration, secret ballots, requiring that voters be alive, and other good government reforms that had the effect of reducing the number of voters and making elections a lot less fun. The third party system lasted from roughly 1860 to 1896, when another pivotal election brought about a change in the composition of one of the parties, in this case, the Democrats. Sometime in the 1880s, and certainly by 1892, a new party, the People's Party, or Populists, began to form in the South and the western parts of the U.S. They had a number of concerns, mainly about regulation of farm prices and railroad shipping rates, but also things like supporting a national income tax and a general mistrust of bankers and plutocrats. Those are the Democrats that live on Pluto. But according to Phil, no one lives on Pluto. Whatever, Phil! They won a few congressional elections, but eventually merged with the Democrats when they nominated the Democrat William Jennings Bryan to be their presidential candidate in 1896. Adding certain elements of populism shored up Democratic support in the South and the Midwest, but for many Americans, their ideas were too radical, and the Democrats were unable to elect any presidential candidates between 1896 and 1932, with one exception, Woodrow Wilson. Good old Woodrow only made it in because the Republican vote in 1912 was split between the establishment candidate Taft and former President Theodore Roosevelt, who started his own progressive party. The rise and fall of the populists shows us something important about third parties in American politics. The first thing is that they never win, largely because of the way American elections are structured. But this doesn't mean that they don't matter. Third parties can shift the terms of political debate. Without a socialist party, and there was one, believe it or not, issues of workers' rights wouldn't have been nearly as prevalent in the early part of the 20th century. Eagle was in the shot. I didn't want it to be. Didn't want it to influence political debate. Often third-party ideas get incorporated into the platforms of one of the other parties. This happened with the populists, as their plans for a graduated national income tax and direct election of senators were eventually incorporated into the Constitution in the 16th and 17th Amendments. After the election of 1932, when Franklin Roosevelt became president and the Great Depression had kind of discredited Republican economic policies, the Democrats were dominant in both houses of Congress as well. Thanks to these advantages, the Democratic Party saw another shift in its composition and priorities, one so big that we say that the new fifth-party system was the result. The Democrats' New Deal policy brought more groups into the party's fold. Support for organized labor, especially the Wagner Act, attracted union workers. The idea that government could work to alleviate poverty through research and planning attracted some socialists and many upper-middle-class intellectuals, including a large percentage of American Jewish community. Southern farmers, always a backbone of the Democrats, were attracted by New Deal farm policies. New Deal support for jobs and FDR's repeal of prohibition helped bring urban immigrants, especially Catholics, into the Democrats' camp. And Democrats' acknowledgement that African Americans were suffering, especially hard from the Depression, helped shift African-American support away from the party of Lincoln. This was a major realignment, as black people, when they could vote in America, had until the New Deal voted overwhelmingly for Republicans. And even though New Deal programs did very little for black people, the programs were often quite discriminatory, the impression that the Democrats and FDR were champions of the poor helped convince many African-Americans to vote Democrat. And they remain one of the most consistent groups in terms of their party affiliation. The coalition of groups that make up the Democratic Party, sometimes called the New Deal Coalition, also my band name in high school, has been pretty stable for quite some time, as has the coalition that makes up the Republican Party. This is why some people suggest that there have only been five party systems, with the fifth beginning in roughly 1932 and continuing to the present. I disagree! As do other historians and political scientists. My people. My posse. I bet they all have beards, too. Us six-systemers argue for a further realignment of support after 1968 and consider the current political climate to be a sixth-party system. The main shift here, and in terms of Congress, it has been really huge, is that the South, which used to be solidly Democratic, is now pretty unshakably Republican. Most historians will tell you that this has largely to do with race and the Democrats' support of the 1964 Civil Rights Act and 1965 Voting Rights Act, and we don't have time to go into just how true that is. What we can say is that for whatever reason, the Republican Party now draws a lot of support from white, middle, and lower-middle-class voters, especially in the South and Midwest, and that these were groups that used to vote for Democrats. A major part of this realignment is white working class men, who generally used to be reliable union Democrats, but are now just as likely to vote Republican. The Democrats have maintained their support among liberal intellectuals, members of minority groups, and to a lesser degree, women, but their coalition is much less powerful than it used to be. We could say a lot more about political parties in America and how they might be changing as we speak, but as I promised, this episode has been about history and how we got to where we are. If you're going to take away anything, it should be that political parties change over time, both in terms of their policies and the groups that support them, and that it's often historical contingent that cause these shifts. And although we pretty much always had a two-party system, third parties are still valuable, even though they never win, because they help frame issues and move the terms of political debate and even of policy. It's like me. I've never won an internet award, but I made up the word doobly-doo, so. Crash Course Government and Politics is produced in association with PBS Digital Studios.
all the time we have this week. This is Don saying, eyes open, minds on.
If you wish to make an apple pie from scratch, you must first invent the universe.
Thanks for listening to Radio Free Thinker. Remember to visit us online at radiofreethinker.com and subscribe to the podcast on iTunes. If you have any local skeptical events you would like us to mention on the air, email us at info@radiofreethinker.com.